Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. What would you think if people started suggesting one way we could cut back on harmful emissions is eat insects? Edible insects, yeah, it's a big deal. Not so aesthetic. I'll talk about that. Also today, we're going to explore the idea that we're one step closer to finding out how wine may protect your neurons from the Institute for Food Science and Research in Spain. And teens and adolescents who consume too much salt show unhealthy changes in their blood vessels, from the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. And lutein and xanthan benefits more than just your eyes. Give you the latest on that. Also, a lot more on health and healing. My guest in the second part of our program today, talking on a topic that does not get the attention it deserves, and that is war and conflict is a commodity for the transnational capital elite and class and the new emerging globalized society. This is a deep topic. My guest, capable of carrying the conversation, you bet, Professor William Robinson, Professor of Sociology, University of California at Santa Barbara. He is also on the university's faculty for Latin American Studies and in the Global International Studies program. He's a scholar activist, and we're going to talk about how we are being commodified. And in the process of commodification, they then set the agenda for us. They tell us what our priorities should be. They say that what should be funded and not funded, the real faces and people behind the hidden hand. Also today, I'm going to continue with the historical perspective on all of the major things today in our health and environment that we take for granted. But if there weren't a lot of battles fought, we wouldn't have those freedom todays. And even today, they're still trying to take away our freedoms of choice. So I'll give you that historical perspective. And from our audio file, we're going to hear from George Carlin. He has his own take on those in power. And a law professor explains why you should not talk to the police at all and why. And joining him, I'm only going to play part of it, but joining him in that discussion is a leading chief of police that he invited on to see if he made any mistakes. Interesting conversation, things we don't think about. So we have a lot to share, and we always begin on something that can impact everyone in the audience, and that's health and healing. Now, I want to begin by taking a look at something that is happening around the world. In fact, it's happening out of necessity in Africa, in Asia, in India, and that is the eating of insects. From the University of Edinburgh, they did a study finding that insect protein instead of beef could help tackle climate change by reducing harmful emissions linked to livestock production. And replacing half the meat eaten worldwide with crickets and mealworms would cut farmland use by a third, substantially reducing emissions of greenhouse gases. And while consumers most would be reluctant to eat insects, and that would limit their consumption, even a small increase would bring benefits, so the team says. And using data collected primarily from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, scientists have compared the environmental impact of conventional meat production with those of alternative sources of food. And it's the first to do so. And this was done at Scotland's Royal College. And they said we should be eating insects instead of meat, and it could help. All right, that's one point of view, and certainly it's worth considering. Here's another. Why not start the whole process of a meatless diet, meaning we do not need any animal, insect, mammal to get our protein? there is nothing from animals that we need. And for more than 70 years, we were living with this myth. In fact, I grew up where every single family I knew had to have, for breakfast, it was bacon and eggs or bacon and sausage with a glass of milk. And for lunch, it was Campbell's tomato soup with a grilled cheese sandwich. And for dinner, you always had to have some kind of meat, and one night it would be chicken. On Friday night, for some reason, I have no idea why, it was fish sticks. And the rest of the time, it was steak. But then on Sunday, it was roast beef. And I think it was roast beef because Mom would put it on before we went to church. And because I wouldn't eat the beef, she would also add on some vegetables. And then after church, we go home, and there would be the meat and what I'm assuming were the vegetables. Now, it kind of all at that point looked like paste, the broccoli or potatoes or carrots, because when you cook something for 3 or 4 hours, a vegetable along with beef, you're not going to have anything that looks or tastes like it's supposed to. But that's how we grew up. And I remember once asking Mom why we had the meat every day. And she said, because you have to have meat in order to have muscles. If you don't have the meat, you won't have muscles. You end up puny. And that's the entire medical and scientific community acceptance. In fact, one of my textbooks in dietetic school was Normal and Therapeutic Nutrition. And in it, it was very clear and specific that only animal proteins, such as fish, chicken, beef, pork, dairy, eggs, contain all 8 essential amino acids. That vegetables were partially complete and fruits were very incomplete. And hence the idea that as long as you had meat every day, you were fine. You didn't have to have many vegetables and you didn't have to have fruit. Most of the time you didn't get fresh fruit. You had fruit out of a jar or can. It was heavily sugared. And the vegetables were heavily salted. And everything kind of tasted mushy. That is how it went. I remember the first time I was thrown out of dietetic class. It would happen 5 times with 5 different teachers. It was not because I was argumentative or disrespectful. Rather, I simply asked questions that they couldn't give me an answer, and they thought I was being, you know, argumentative because they couldn't answer. And I simply said, how do you account for people in South America, especially those people that only have animal proteins on occasion or celebration, but by and large their diet is a complex carbohydrate of rice and beans and tubers like breadfruit and cassava? And that was enough to get me thrown out, because I should have known, because the textbook said only animal proteins are complete. And I said, but they're living long lives. And how about the tribes in Africa that live off maize and millet and sorghum and rarely, if ever, have meat? And again, they couldn't accept that there was another reality. Jump ahead to the Institute of Applied Biology, where I was wanting to see how much protein was in some brown rice and some black beans. I was just curious. And because if you look at the can, it says, well, for most beans, 7 grams, more or less, except for soybeans, which can have up to 5 times that amount, 25, 27 grams. And when I was doing my amino acid analysis, I discovered that I counted over 8 essential amino acids. And I thought, well, this can't be right. I left it for Dr. Berman to check me, and I made a note that, Vic, I made a mistake. Could you redo this? Next day I came in, he said, no mistake. I still felt that he was wrong also, so I redid it. I redid it 4 or 5 times. And then I had one of those ooh-ah moments. I will never forget it. I walked out on the street, walked down from the 3rd floor where I was, walked out on the street, walked around the block, walked over to a friend at Trafalgar Hospital, and I said, you think it's possible that everyone in the field of health, all the doctors, nurses, dietitians, scientists, have been wrong about something? They said, unlikely. I said, that would mean every textbook, every scientific article, every class on home economics, everything we've ever learned is wrong. How is that possible? That can't be possible. And yet I'm coming up with results that's showing they're wrong. And I remember the head of the institute that I spoke privately about this. He said, well, he said, the only way to know if you're wrong or they're wrong is to disprove yourself. So I went back into the lab, and for the next 2 months, I did everything possible to find if I had made a mistake. And I couldn't. And I gave it to other people, Dr. Hillard Fiske and others, show me where I've made a mistake. And it came back finally, had made a mistake. So I then spent the next 2 years compiling a list of commonly edible foods and how much of a percentage of each amino acid did we have. And then I did a project and I submitted it for publication. I sent it to the USDA, the FDA, the National Institutes of Health. I sent it everywhere. Over 400 different magazines and publications in the scientific and medical and dietetic journals, the American Dietetic Association sent it to them, because it literally is one of those major moments where an entire paradigm is found to be wrong. And I had the proof of it. 12 years went by without a single rejection, but not a single acceptance, before it was finally published in a peer-reviewed journal. And then it was of no interest to anyone. And so I did my own press conference on it. About 1,700 people from this audience came, and I published a book on it called The Egg Project. And The Egg Project was because the highest form of protein was considered the egg. There was no more protein ever that was better assimilated by the body, and hence the term net protein utilization, net, how much of the actual protein is going to be utilized in the body, was the egg. I had surpassed that with 3 different foods, including spirulina and chlorella. Both had higher net protein utilizations. So on several different fronts, we had a whole new game ahead of us. From then till now, science, nutrition, dietetics has simply decided not to pay attention to it. And they keep eating meat. And the reason why is because there's a hundreds of billions of dollar year industry that would be impacted. Eggs, dairy, beef, chicken, fish. People actually believe you need this stuff. You don't. So the idea that when I read an article, well-intentioned and well-done, from the University of Edinburgh, they're starting off with a false premise that only animal proteins are essential in their amino acid composition. And I'm showing, no, all grains, legumes, nuts, seeds have all 8 essential amino acids in different combinations. So by simple combinations, you can exceed the net protein utilization of any animal protein. So there's no need for insects ever whatsoever. All you have to know is, are you getting the right combination? And if you're eating beans and grains, let's say you have some quinoa and you have some navy beans, or you want spelt with kidney beans, or you want amaranth with soybeans, fine, you're way up there in net protein utilization. So just a different thing. And I know we have people from the UN listening. In fact, when I was a keynote speaker on Earth Day, and again on Solstice, after the lecture, a gentleman came over who was high up at the UN, and he said, we rarely hear anyone who's critical of environmental organizations. Your whole lecture today was you were critical of environmental organizations for selling out on important environmental issues, depending upon who gave them big grants. And though people may not like what you had to say, it's important that we hear this. So here's something for the UN. When I did this research, one of the very first people I contacted was the head of a major UN program helping starving people. We met. I went over all the charts and I said, here are the grains, legumes and gourds, things that require little water that could be planted. And I had a map of all the different countries of Africa, and especially those that were having droughts or having famine. If you were to encourage these people to plant these products, then you would not have starvation. You would save hundreds of millions of lives of suffering. They agreed. But then about 2 months later, came back and said, the politics of the UN is so corrupt that there's nothing we can do. because now you got to go up against those vendors that are giving non-fat dry milk. I said non-fat dry milk should never be given in Africa because it can cause diarrhea and in the women who are dairy sensitive and intolerant, and therefore their babies will dehydrate and the mothers will not be able to produce enough breast milk. And the formulas they're giving to those babies are with contaminated water. Frequently, the babies die of schistosomiasis and other. It's like you have the biggest group of idiots in the world at the UN. These are some of the god-awful dumbest human beings I've ever dealt with, and also extremely corrupt. So just remember that, just as a historical record, the UN had an opportunity to do the right thing and save millions, hundreds of millions of lives just by knowing what to plant where based upon climatic factors, where they didn't have to keep relying upon, oh, we got to get milk or we got to get dairy, we got to get processed wheat, you know, some kind of gluten flour. Yeah, that's exactly what a person who is malnourished does not need, a gluten flour. You think that because someone works at the UN, these are the best and brightest because they come from Harvard, Yale? No, these are not the best and brightest people on earth. And the UN, in my opinion, is one corrupt organization. Just wanted to share that with you for no particular reason that I wanted to. But it's just my mind sometimes get racing ahead on these issues of connecting the dots. So why don't we do this? Why don't we do something absolutely revolutionarily reactive? Why don't we stop thinking that we ever have to have anything from an animal in our life? Go back to old-fashioned sustainable farming, the kind of America had at one time before the Industrial Revolution, where you're planting locally grown non-GMO organic foods in communities. You can do it year-round through hydroponics, and you can support your local farmers in the process, getting more people going back to the land. Land is inexpensive in a lot of places. As long as you're not near a city, stay 2 hours, 3 hours away from a city, you can buy land dirt cheap. And that way you're giving a wide variety of much healthier foods, and the foods that have a long carbon footprint because they're grown in Mexico, California, Oregon, and then brought in. Why wait to get blueberries from Florida or Maine when you can grow blueberries hydroponically? Yeah, aquaponics and strawberries and raspberries. So much we could do if we were simply open to change. That's how you save the environment. Provide healthier, cleaner, more nourishing food locally grown and lower the carbon footprint. Also, the Institute of Food Science Research in Spain wanted to know what exactly is helping protect the neurons and brains that's in red wine. Well, we knew that there was one important nutrition factor, and that was resveratrol. And they've come up with all these other ideas that red wine derive human gut metabolites are also important, meaning the good bacteria in your gut are actually assisted and helped with the red wine. And that helps prevent their neuron cell dysfunction and death. So the healthier your gut and the healthier the bacteria in your gut, the healthier your brain. Quote, in other words, differences in our gut microbiota are leading to the different metabolites, which underpins the idea that humans benefit from food in different ways. You bet. So, better than wine is grape juice. And better than grape juice is eating grapes. Grapes are one of nature's most perfect foods. And teens and adolescents who consume too much salt, not good for your blood vessels. This is from Cincinnati's Children's Hospital Medical Center. And the findings of a new study were presented at the Pediatric Academic Society's meeting, and they suggest that a lot of young people, adolescents and teens, are eating everything with salt on it, and that's changing the quality of their blood vessels, and that means that instead of having bad blood vessels in your 60s, 70s, and 80s, we're seeing it in their teens or younger. That's correct. Arterial stiffness, sometimes called hardening of the arteries, is a known risk factor for heart attack and strokes in adults. Now we're seeing it in children. And monitors placed on the skin near major arteries in the arm, neck, and groin can detect this condition, which indicates increased risk of heart attack and stroke. All because we want to have everything at salty. The article abstract is entitled Effective Dietary Sodium Consumption on Arterial Stiffness in the Youth. And so what do you do? Well, first, just for today, something very simple. A really healthy item is a baked potato, even sweet potato or yam. But try doing this. After you wash your potato, then put some coconut oil in your hands, massage your hands, and then now massage the potato. Now take a knife and cut about an inch in, about every 2 inches, clear around the potato. What that will do is you can use at least 100 degrees less temperature, which means there's less heat, but the heat is going inside, dissipating, and as a result is being more uniformly cooked. Then when it's done and you open it up, whatever you like in the way of filling, I happen to like shiitake mushrooms, lightly sauteed with raw sweet onions, and then put some pepper on it. Now, instead of salt, squeeze the juice of fresh lemons on it. 2 lemons on a baked potato, sweet potato, or yam. It's delicious. And if you do want something different, bake organic potatoes that are looking like French fries, cut as French fries, and then instead of putting salt on it, you can put toasted sesame seeds and lemon juice, fresh squeezed lemon juice. Watch how the kids say, wow, this tastes great. And then make sure your kid is getting some potassium each day. Coconut water, 400 to 500 milligrams, that's good. Bananas are good. We're taking 400 or 500 milligrams of potassium in supplemental form because we have too little potassium and we have too much sodium. And that's the latest on Health and Healing. I'm Gary Noll. And so when you look in the mainstream media or even the alternative media, where are you finding out about the war crimes and genocide that is occurring around the world? Let me just give you one example from anti-media from Darius, and that is in Yemen. Now, I've mentioned this many times, so let's put some of the pieces together to see if this makes sense. On the one hand, we're saying we have to have 56% of our national budget go to the military-industrial complex, about 400,000 different military contractors, in order for them to spend that money to keep us safe from terrorist attack. However, we say we're also going to destroy ISIS. Now, that's on one side, and people believe that and buy into it. On the other side, we have been funding terrorist groups, including the Mujahideen, which became al-Qaeda, in funding them through Pakistan, arming them through Pakistan into Afghanistan when the Russians were there for their long order. Their Vietnam was in Afghanistan. And when we won that and Russia pulled out, all those arms training and all those radical Islamists, including Osama bin Laden, did not have to disarm. They didn't have to give anything back. We did the same thing in the Balkans, in Croatia. And for at least the last 7 years, we've been funding al-Nusra and al-Qaeda through Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates. We are supplying massive amounts of arms to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the sponsor of the most radicalized form of Islam there is, and that's Wahhabism, which is a sect of Islam. It was not a part of original Islam, and that's why so many of the people practicing Islamic beliefs do not subscribe at all to Wahhabist values. But Saudi Arabia's got itself into a pickle, and that pickle is that on the one hand, if it stopped all the hate campaigns and propaganda campaigns in its own madrasas, its own schools, its religious schools, if it stopped funding ISIS and al-Nusra and al-Qaeda for their expeditions into Syria and also into Yemen, then they're going to have blowback. So how can we say that we're against terrorism? How can we say we're fighting ISIS when we continue to fund and support unequivocally and without condemnation Saudi Arabia? Not only do we not condemn Saudi Arabia, but as a part of the permanent members of the UN Security Council, we actually endorse them becoming the chief person on the Human Rights Committee. Now think of this for a moment. They hate gays and they throw gays off buildings, and then if they should survive being thrown off a building, they then behead them. They still believe in stoning. They practice strict Sharia law. They had more beheadings last year than ISIS, and they frequently do a double tap. They behead a person and then they crucify them. This is something that's medieval. This is something primordial. This is a kind of mindset that has to have a redefinition, because sociopathology, sociopaths, psychopaths, doesn't begin to touch the extreme behavior of these individuals, and yet they're treated with such respect in the United States, much like Israel. So no matter what they do, we refuse to acknowledge them. So then we're over there saying we've got to do something about Islam, we've got to do something about terrorism. And yet the very perpetrators, the funders, the enablers, we don't touch, we don't discuss. If the public were to rely solely on the U.S. government and its respective mouthpieces for its source of news, one might assume Iran is to blame for the current crisis engulfing Yemen, the Arab world's poorest country. Quote, at least 10,000 people have been killed and more than 3 million displaced in the war in Yemen, now in its third year. Millions of people are also struggling to feed themselves. We will have to overcome Iran's efforts to destabilize yet another country and create another militia in their image of Lebanese Hezbollah. But the bottom line is we are on the right path for it. That was said by Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis. And he told reporters that in Saudi Arabia. So he's saying the only problem we have in Yemen is Iran. But according to anti-media, it's not true. In fact, there was an article written in 2015 for Truthout in which Darius analyzed a number of Guardian articles claiming without question that the Houthi rebels leading an insurrection in Yemen were Iran-backed. Most of the time, the claim was presented without any evidence through the Guardian, though the Guardian occasionally provided a hyperlink for the source. By clicking on the hyperlink, it was found the Guardian was failing to provide evidence that Iran was backing rebels in Yemen. No, it's not that. It's Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the person, is the country responsible for what we're seeing in Yemen. And who backs Saudi Arabia? The United States. Who backs its cluster bombs? We do. Its airplanes? We do. Its missiles? We do. Who gives it its trajectory for those missiles off satellite? We do. As do the other Gulf War states. So the poorest country in the Middle East, the one with the least arms, least able to defend itself, who's been living under the yoke of Saudi control and rule, and no one's looking at it, the media refuses to touch it. Quote, Yemen is home to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the brand of al-Qaeda that washed and previously regarded as the deadliest. It is also home to ISIS because the terror group capitalized on the instability and managed to latch itself onto a decent foothold in the war-torn country. Yet Saudi Arabia is not targeting either of these two groups. They're not targeting ISIS, they're not targeting al-Qaeda. Further, the Houthi rebels are actually sworn enemies of these two violent terror groups. If Washington were genuine in prosecuting its war against al-Qaeda and ISIS, then the Houthis would technically be a natural ally. So who are the Saudis bombing? Civilians, plain and simple. And then it goes on to talk about how many civilians have been killed or injured. And it's just staggering. All of which we are aware of, all of which we're supporting. So the next time anyone from the CIA, the National Security Council, or the people out of the White House who claim to have any knowledge of anything, because I think that if you took a general IQ of the people working in the White House and the president on, your body temperature would be higher. So we have been lied to, manipulated at every turn on how to address terrorism, the fact that we have allowed the military-industrial complex to be the 8,000-pound gorilla in the room that no one's paying attention to, and they've simply completely eviscerated social services, infrastructure, de-ghettoizing America, feeding hungry Americans, all the things that people would appreciate and could benefit from. No, that doesn't get their attention. Supporting terrorist organizations through their proxy governments like Saudi Arabia and Turkey, yeah, that we do real well. And where's the media to challenge it? Where's the New York Times? Where's the Washington Post? Is there no ethics? Is there no honor? Is there no decency? Is there no spiritual commitment at all left in the American media? They're a disgrace. Those are my own personal feelings. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
Okay, so your heart broke. You sit around moping.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. And we're going to Santa Barbara, California, where Professor William Robinson is standing by. He is professor of sociology, University of California at Santa Barbara. He is also on the university's faculty of Latin American Studies and in the Global and International Studies program. You could describe him as a scholar activist. He's deeply involved in American domestic and third world struggles for social justice, popular empowerment of populations, and particularly democracy and government. His areas of focus include globalization, transnationalism, political economics, immigration, and a variety of sociological issues. He received his graduate degree from the University of New Mexico. He's published 8 books, his latest being Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity, which takes an honest but a searing look at the totalitarian structures and agendas of the transnational capitalist class that promotes neoliberal restructuring and trade liberalization. Nice to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure to be on your show, Gary.
In order for us to posit the idea that the U.S. is a totalitarian state ruled by transnational capital and influence, we would need to conclude that private global capitalist interests have taken control of the nation's, even our government's finances, and thereby have control over how financial revenues and debt are used. And this would require a structure mechanism to be put into place that enables private transnational economic interests to dictate politics. So in what ways is this becoming the law of the land under the Trump's policy so far? The forum is yours.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we've seen an unprecedented in the history of humanity concentration of wealth in the 1% of humanity. Your listeners know all of that. They know this trifurcation of humanity. 1% of humanity now controls more than 50% of the world's wealth, and then the top 20% control 95% of the world's wealth. That unbelievable concentration of economic power, obviously in the form of the giant global corporations that drive the global economy, shape social and political and cultural institutions all around the world, including the corporate media that you were just talking about previously. And that type of incredible economic, concentrated economic power translates into political influence, really political domination over states. And that type of domination takes place through many levels. It allows the transnational capitalist class to shape the outcome of electoral processes around the world. And of course, when they're not able to do so, there's always the U.S. military and the repression and overthrow of those governments that might come to power. But it also allows the transnational capitalist class to shape public agendas, to shape public consciousness, to shape cultural production, and also to place its own agents in states around the world. And the most glaring example is the United States, where you have the billionaires of the transnational capitalist class and the military generals, and the role of the Pentagon and the military generals, and you are pointing that out, is to defend and sustain and advance this type of a global capitalist system. So, in essence, incredible economic power concentrated in transnational capitalist class means that it wields this unbelievable political influence, but also ideological and cultural influence through the major social institutions of our world.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. There are quite a few different areas about the overemphasis on America building up its military and expanding armed conflict around the world that has now gone into hyperactive mode under Trump. But one of the more important areas which you have identified is the increasing ownership of war and conflict by the private, transnational, and corporate class and its influence upon our government's foreign affairs. For example, just hours after Trump's missile attack on the Syrian government facility, Raytheon's stock rose $1 billion. Trump's $65 billion increase in the defense budget will largely be spent on contracts with private corporations that serve the Pentagon and the national security state. The elite who can invest in the private military-industrial complex are becoming increasingly wealthy, and war and conflict is turning into a tradable commodity. It's insane and even sadistic that the lack of ethical integrity behind the privatization of war is a financial asset for capitalist growth. So please take your time. I think we really need depth on this one. Outline the emergence of a transnational capitalist class that is increasingly benefiting solely on war and conflict. And how does that war as a new investment incentive relate to the restructuring that occurred after the 2008 financial meltdown and recession under Bush and Obama, and also would have been under Clinton as well?
Yes. I mean, the question goes really to the core of what's going on in our world today, and allows us to connect the dots of many different particular circumstances and things going on in the world. I mean, the story has to start with the crisis of global capitalism. I mean, we're in the worst crisis in humanity's history. It's ecological. It's at all different levels. It's a crisis of survival for the majority of the world's people. But in order to explain that linkage between what we now have, a global war economy and a world war order, and we're going to see an escalation of international conflicts all around the world for a very long time to come. I wish I could say that that's not true, but that's where we're headed. And we're also faced the threat of a major international conflagration of unforeseen circumstances. And the two greatest dangers facing humanity is ecological collapse and the threat of nuclear war. But what is the structural backdrop that even those of us on the left that talk about don't really focus on? And it's the structural dimension of this global crisis. And so one of the contradictions of the capitalist system, it produces all of this wealth, but it polarizes that wealth, as I just mentioned, and as we all know. And what that means is that the vast majority of the world's population cannot actually purchase and consume and absorb what this world economy, the global economy, puts out. 80% of humanity has no purchasing power. That's 5% of the world's wealth. And so that means that the global corporations need to find other outlets for constantly making profit, constantly accumulating capital. And before I get to how the militarization of the world and conflict and war has become that principal outlet, let's see what they have tried to do over the last 20 years. What are their other outlets? Again, because they can't produce healthcare and education and homes and public transportation and food and clothing for the world's majority that can't purchase any of that. In other words, the global market cannot absorb the global output of the global economy. So they've done quite a number of things. One, they've turned to raiding and sacking public budgets. So public budgets and public finances now to subsidize capital, while austerity is ever, you know, it's imposed on the majority of the world's people, including, of course, here in the United States. And that's the Trump economic program. Despite his populist discourse, it's basically neoliberalism and capitalist globalization on steroids. And let's remember that after the 2008 financial collapse, the U.S. state bailed out the banks and corporations to the tune of $17 trillion. I mean, a figure we can't even wrap our minds around. But structurally what's going on there is that you need to take over public finance and restructure it to keep capitalism, the global capitalist system, making profits and accumulating capital in the face of this stagnation and this crisis. But that has its limits, and we've reached those limits. The other thing, and this I have some dramatic data here, is the expansion of credit. So you massively inundate the 20% of humanity that can consume with credit cards and with student loans and with mortgages and auto loans and so forth. And so I have some, you know, incredible data here. Just in 2016, just in the United States, we're not talking about worldwide, working class households owed $13 trillion in student loans and credit card debt and auto loans and in mortgages. Now, to put that in context also of this mechanism of global debt to keep the global economy going, the global bond market, and a bond market is an indicator, the bond market's an indicator of total government debt worldwide, that surpassed $100 trillion in 2011, meaning that governments borrow money from the private financial institutions, banks and financial institutions, and of course that money is then extracted from the global working class through taxes to pay back to the financial institutions. And so you see this credit mechanism is also not working to avert another global collapse. And then the third mechanism, before we see how militarization is now the new mechanism, or really generalized in global society. The third has been financial speculation. And again, your listeners are very familiar with that, but not to the extent that we have never seen such type of financial speculation. And to put it in perspective, the global world product, that's what we call the total value of goods and services produced worldwide. Global world product in 2015 was $75 trillion. The world produced real goods and real services for $75 trillion. In that same year, $5.3 trillion was speculated in currency speculation alone every day. So within just a few weeks, it surpasses the entire output of goods and services worldwide. And now this figure, absolutely mind-boggling. In that same year that the world produced $75 trillion in goods and services, the global derivatives market, which is basically a market in every type of speculation, reached a mind-boggling $1.2 quadrillion. So you see that financial speculation is simply postponing the day of reckoning for a new collapse. And most people are predicting, myself included, that it's almost inevitable, another major collapse. But this, and so it also means that there's this ever greater underlying instability to the global economy and global society. And instability means political and social upheavals and protests and clashes and conflict everywhere. And so that poses a political threat. How do you control the mass of humanity, which is sinking ever deeper and deeper into crises of survival? But that leads to the fourth mechanism, which is now becoming generalized. How do you keep the global economy going in the face of these circumstances? And that leads to what I call what you've been referring to before the break, and what I call militarized accumulation, in the sense that the transnational, while politicians that represent the dominant groups, and while the generals that love war because that's their own institution and their own expansion, while they are concentrating on geopolitical justifications and political justifications for increased militarization and global warfare, at the level of the transnational capitalist class, and as you put it, wars, military conflicts, social conflict and upheaval, and repressing them and developing systems of mass repression and mass social control become a way of continuing to accumulate capital and generate profits worldwide in the face of this stagnation and the failure of these other mechanisms that we've been that I've been mentioning. So you have all of these bogus wars, a war on drugs, which has nothing to do with a war on drugs, the war on terrorism, and you spoke about that very elegantly right before you brought me on. war on immigrants, the construction of border walls all around, the proliferation of immigrant detention centers, the ever-growing prison industrial complex, the installation of mass surveillance systems, the increasing expansion of private security guard companies and mercenary companies. So all of this means that the transnational capitalist class has acquired this deep vested interest in a global war order, in a global militarized economy, and in endless conflicts and wars. And you mentioned 2008. Yes, this accelerates in the wake of the 2008 financial collapse, but really, we want to push it back a little further to September of 2001. And what you see is that military spending, and this is around the world, not just in the U.S. The U.S. leads the way as the dominant power in the world. Military spending skyrocketed into the trillions of dollars after 2001 with the so-called war on terrorism, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, and everything that's happened since. So here's another data that shocks. I mean, we've heard about this, but when you see the data, it never stops to, it never ceases to shock. That the Pentagon budget, you mentioned the increase of $55 billion, which Trump is proposing, but the Pentagon budget increased 91% in real terms between 1998 and 2011. And that doesn't even include the special war appropriations, the special appropriations. And in the decade from 2001 to 2011, defense industry profits nearly quadrupled. So, I mean, you can see the very direct line there. The U.S. state and also other governments around the world mobilize, take away from other types of spending, including social spending, incredibly beef up military spending, and that leads to a quadrupling of defense industry profits in that period because they can't make profits by producing schools and housing and healthcare and clothing and food for the world's people. And then that's, the U.S. is one part of it, but worldwide, total military defense outlays grew by 50% between 2006 and 2015 to $1.4 trillion to $2.03 trillion. So, this is the structural backdrop, and this is how this has evolved to now where, you and I might say, gosh, there could be a nuclear war in the Korean Peninsula. These guys are crazy. Well, gosh, they're going to spend $30 billion to build this useless wall, which has nothing to do with, with holding back the exploitation of immigrant labor and so forth. But from the logic of this global capitalist system in crisis and the transnational capitalist class, this is the way that now that they are keeping the system going and generating this massive profit-making. Now, to link it to the first thing you asked me, when you have this unbelievable concentration of power, economic and political and geopolitical military power in what I call a military security industrial financial complex, then that is translated into power in the halls of Washington and the political centers around the world. So we see this restructuring of global politics, of global power relations, and the militarization of political and social institutions. And you also see, Gary, I want to also point this out. You also see this reflected in Hollywood and mass culture and the mass media. So you've seen this slew in the last, especially since 2001, but even more recently, a slew of films coming out of Hollywood, and they're seen worldwide, of course, right? They're exported all around the world and translated into these languages, which glorifies militarization, glorifies domination, glorifies conflict, and has recasted the image of things of agencies such as the Central Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon and Special Forces as, glorified heroes and heroines and the champions of democracy and freedom around the world. So that's part of the, the cultural and ideological dimensions of this new globalized war system. And you pointed out, very importantly, that Raytheon stocks increased overnight by $100 billion when those Tomahawk missiles were launched. But expand that a little bit. After Donald Trump's electoral victory, the stock price of the Corrections Corporation of America, which is they have run 70% of the private immigrant detention facilities, their stock prices soared 40% overnight, the day after Trump was elected, because of his promise to massively build new immigrant detention centers and deport immigrants. And then we've seen the charts and data over the last 15, 20 years where every time there's a flare up of the conflict in the Middle East, such as what you're talking about in Yemen and so forth, there's a the stock of Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and all of these military conflicts, they suddenly jump. And look what happened when Trump announced that he's taking bids. His government, his administration, or his regime, I don't call it an administration, is taking bids for the construction of the so-called U.S., the border wall with Mexico. 500 giant corporations from all around the world, not just the United States, put bids in. Like they're salivating how they can make profits on this. So, just to conclude, to summarize, these are the structural underpinnings and the context in which we're seeing these conflicts all around the world, which are putting humanity into the gravest danger that we've ever been in.
William, I'd like to address several of the things you've just said and put it into possibly a little different context. I see that America is bankrupt. I see the world is bankrupt. But the trouble is we don't have one economy. We have seven economies. So if you are one of the people in the, let's say, the rarefied air of 1,600 billionaires, you're not going to suffer. We have 8 million millionaires. You're not going to suffer. But for a lot of people, they're suffering. And the people who are making the money are making it off debt. Now, you mentioned the debt, and you were absolutely accurate in your debt statistics, but here let me fill in the blanks here. The current gross domestic product is $18.9 trillion, but that's not real because $5 trillion of that comes from credit cards and people buying things without disposable income. They're not going to their savings account and say, I'd like to buy an extra coat, or I can pay cash for a car. These people are paying for rent and insurances that if they didn't have a credit card, that they don't have money to back up, they couldn't pay for that and it'd be foreclosed on. So that's not real domestic product. Also, Wall Street represents anywhere from 12 to 14% of that. And that money does not recirculate back into society, nor does it trickle down, nor is it shared. So there's an income inequality. Then you have the total U.S. debt, $68.7 trillion. The national debt, $19.8 trillion. U.S. federal spending, $4 trillion. The State Department debt, or state debt at New York and all the rest, $1.2 trillion. A local debt, cities, $1.9 trillion. Interest paid on the debt, $2.5 trillion. Total personal debt, $18 trillion. Mortgage debt, $14 trillion. Student debt, $1.4 trillion. Credit card debt, $1 trillion. Car debt, $1 trillion. Social Security liability, $16 trillion. Unfunded liabilities, $106 trillion. Add that together, you're at $170 trillion. Now, we think that countries like Greece that are going through stupid and criminal austerity programs, taking away people's pensions so they have to dumpster dive, that these people are a basket case because they have 300% debt to their income. We have 1,200% debt to income. And so when you look at your derivative market that you were mentioning, there is just five banks in the United States. Just in the United States, five banks, you're dealing with over $400 trillion. And what is bad about that is the banking community has managed to what we call lock in and front load in their responsibilities, meaning that when you put money in a bank today, savings or checking, it's no longer your money. You are, in effect, becoming a member of that bank. You're not told that. And if there's not a crisis, you can get your money out. But if there's a crisis, all those bank accounts stop, they freeze. And then just like Cyprus, the people that get their money back are the money who the people are holding those derivatives. They're the ones who get bailed out first. And then we get a share, a minuscule share that is worth nothing in the bank. They're now, right as we speak, they're trying to redo the Dodd-Frank. They're also trying to undo all of the regulations they had after the 2007 crash. And we have a bubble. The real value of Wall Street right now of equities should be around 7,000. We're going towards 22,000. That's a bubble. Commercial real estate, a bubble. Credit card, a bubble. Student debt, a bubble. And the rebubbling of the reinflation of the bubble for the subprime, we're living in a bubble economy that's going to collapse. Not will it. It's going to. And when it does, you're going to have to ask the media, where were you, Wall Street Journal? Where were you, Forbes? Where you were, MSNBC and Fox News? Where were the pundits? Where the people say, buy America and go out and spend money? Go ahead and buy your dream, buy a house. Where were the people when this happens who are going to be, we're wrong in the past and are going to be wrong again? and look at the suffering that that's going to unleash, and look at the power that that will give for those who masterminded one of the biggest coups in world history. Your final thoughts?
Yes. I mean, I agree completely with what you said. It allows us to connect some of the dots here. So let me just first, my final thoughts first, put that into some analytical context, but secondly, link that to the issue of military and conflict and the repression, which is coming. So, I mean, what you're referring to is this ever-widening gap between what we call the real economy, that is, again, the production of houses and clothing and schools and so forth, and the fictitious economy, which is all of that debt and all of that finance, which has nothing to do with the real economy. And it never in the history of records that we kept in humanity has that gap been greater. And so what that means is that we're ever in hock to the banks and the financial speculators and financial institutions. But it also means that that ever increasing debt on the one hand, it justifies the further dismantling of public sectors, the further privatization. And Trump is now proposing this mass, and the transnational capitalist class is very happy with it, is proposing massive reduction in corporate taxes. So that is going to further undermine public budgets and, you know, the ability of the U.S. government, but this is also around the world to have a tax base, and then that's going to justify further spending cuts and dismantling of public sectors and everything that we need to survive. So, but here's the thing: here's how I want to link this to what we were talking about: wars and militarization around the world. As you pointed out directly, I could not agree more. The new collapse is inevitable. But what's going to happen with that new collapse is not just going to be in the United States. The Chinese economy, for instance, which in many respects drives the whole global economy, its output and its exporting to the United States and the rest of the world, it's dependent on that debt and debt-driven consumption in the United States and in other rich countries. And so China's economy is going to collapse when the U.S. economy collapses, and that's going to have a chain reaction all over the world. But here's where militarization enters the picture. We were talking about all this militarization as a boom for profit-making for the transnational capitalist class, but at the same time, when this collapse comes, there's going to be, and already is, but there's going to be intensified mass uprising, social protests, political conflict all around the world. And that's where the global police state and the global war system comes further into focus as a system of mass repression and social control, including, you know, the outright development of fascist regimes to contain a lid on these social and political explosions that are coming worldwide. So you were talking about Yemen, but we can, you know, imagine a scenario. And then we have to hope that it doesn't get to this, because the counter to all of this is resistance and fightbacks from below in myriad of ways. But we're talking about the Yemenization of the United States and of the whole global system when this collapse comes, and when this collapse comes in the context of a global war order and a global military machine like we've never seen before.
And I believe it will come within the next 24 months. I hope not, but there's just too much posturing and too much saber-rattling with North Korea, and there's too much destabilization in the Middle East. So we're in for some very serious upheaval, and I hope people prepare themselves by becoming educated. One way you can educate yourself is by reading the book. The book is called Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity by Professor William Robinson. Thank you for being with us today.
It's always a pleasure, Gary. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.